Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Old Men and the Three ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good, but that's when you say to yourself, it's time to get back in the game and take as much of my friend's money as I possibly can. That's right. The hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to be the biggest tycoon ever. It's classic Monopoly, but anytime with tons of twists. Play on countless Monopoly boards, charge your friends rent, or smash their landmarks with a wrecking ball. You can even team up with friends for extra rewards. So put on your game face and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play. You know, these long West Coast trips to call games have given me the gift of time. Time to put on some headphones and listen to my favorite audio titles on Audible. Audible offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. From bestsellers and new releases to celebrity memoirs, mysteries, and thrillers, motivation, wellness, business, and more. Now, I personally love a good murder mystery, and I'm currently listening to An Honest Man by Michael Corita. It's about murders on a yacht. What more do I need to say? As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/JJ or text JJ to 500-500. That's audible.com/JJ or text JJ to 500-500.
We also should shout out your new friend who recently started working in real estate and now says location, location, location all the time. Shout out to the friend who withhold repayment until you finally agree that who's the greatest of all time?
It's got to be Leo, right?
We can do Leo for now. I think Leo works. And to the friend who can't dance, shout out to the friend who sends GIF reactions entirely too much for anyone's taste, JJ. And to the friend who thinks you're related. And to the friend who drew their cat on their custom cash card, shout out to you, sir.
I am a GIFer. Cash App is the easy way for you and all your friends to enjoy sending, spending, saving, investing, splitting, tipping, donating, gifting, or just pressing buttons to look busy, all with the number one finance app in the App Store. That's money. That's Cash App. Download Cash App from the App Store or Google Play Store today to create your own cash tag. Welcome to The Old Man of the Three with JJ Redick and Tommy Alter, presented by Cash App and brought to you by 342 Productions. This is episode 135. Steph Curry. Steph will be joining us in a little bit here in Houston, Texas. Tommy, when you do the Mount Rushmore of the Old Man of the Three podcast, this has to be on the Mount Rushmore.
I would say so.
I would say greatest episodes we've done.
I would say when we started this show, this was one that was on the bucket list.
Yeah.
As our first or second guest.
I think the term is called white whales. Is that right? White whales, like something you're chasing, something you dream about. And I've got a list of three people that are like my bucket list and have been since I started podcasting 7 years ago. Steph has been on that the whole time. Happy to have sat down with him a night in between games here in Houston, Texas. I called the Warriors game last night, took the red eye after the game, got to Houston. You flew in last night. Jason came in from Oklahoma. We're here. We're getting this done. It's going to be awesome.
So you called the game last night, like you mentioned. What'd you think?
I was really happy because Clay had a good game, and so much has been made about his struggles going into last night, but he was solid, shot around 50% from the field, got off to a great start. It was interesting. Early in that game, Steph, I think, made a point to look for Clay, to get everyone involved in the offense. We had the audio, from Steve Kerr during different timeouts, and Kerr kept stressing one more pass, one more pass, one more pass. And if you look at their like assist percentage last night, it was amazing. Steph, of course, ended up with 10 assists. This is in a game coming off a 50 ball where, you know, maybe he comes out on a Friday ESPN game and tries to go ballistic, but he recognizes how important Clay playing well is to that team.
Do you feel like being around the group, there's still a level of calm? Obviously, the season has not started how they would have wanted to, or really how I think most people would have predicted, but this is none of these guys' first rodeo.
Yeah, that's the thing that comes with winning at a high level and experience. They're just a few months removed from winning an NBA championship. They've got to figure out
their bench. They've got to act. I think they've got to add some pieces to their bench. They miss Otto Porter. They miss Gary Payton. You need guys off the bench that really just fit into that system and have a really high basketball IQ. And truthfully, this is not a knock on Wiseman or Kuminga or Moses Moody. And those guys, they haven't had enough basketball experience. And that's not an easy thing. You know, they're not getting the runs that the Houston Rockets young guys are getting. They're not getting the runs that the Orlando Magic young guys are getting. They're in a high pressure situation with a timeline based on Steph Curry, who is going to be 35 in a few months. And he's having an unbelievable season. I would actually argue that he's having his best statistical season. Going into last night, I didn't look it up today, but going into last night, Friday night's game against the Knicks, true shooting percentage of over 70%. Career high for him. Career high in points. Career high in rebounds. And this guy's doing it at such a high level. Better statistical season right now than his unanimous MVP year, by the way. Now, that team, of course, was 73-9. And so where do you sort of assess his you know, likelihood that he could win another MVP?
Well, the team just has to improve. They just have to, first of all, have to win a game on the road. Secondly, they just have to win more. I don't think they need to finish, you know, first in the West if he keeps this up. And I don't know where the spot they have to be to really put him in the conversation is, but they're not there right now. My question for you, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, and I want to hear your thoughts on him in the MVP, but just the difference between the starters and the bench on this team and how stark it is. This was from a couple of days ago. The starters are plus 77. The bench is at minus 90. How is this even possible? A, but B, is there, and this is a glass half full sort of way to phrase this question. Is there a world where it's like, if the bench just gets like marginally better with how good the starters are, all of a sudden we're like, oh yeah, this is the team that won a championship last year?
Yeah. So Jordan Poole, when he subs in for Clay and sort of where he's the fifth starter, that group, you know, hasn't been great. The group with Poole for Kevon Looney hasn't been great relative to how you would expect those groups to perform. The one interesting thing in that sort of death lineup 3.0, you know, going into last night, at least Clay's 3-point shooting numbers, he was like 5 for 22. And if you just said, like, if Clay's shooting 35%, all of a sudden that becomes a plus unit. If Clay's shooting 40% with that unit, all of a sudden that's a really good unit. So I think some of this is small sample size. I think DiVincenzo has a chance to figure that out. He had some good moments last night. And I think Jermichael Green has some good moments last night and has a chance to figure that out. In terms of the MVP right now on DraftKings Sportsbook, Steph is currently ranked 4th in the MVP race with odds of plus 900. Right now, he's behind Luka Doncic, Giannis Antetokounmpo, and Jason Tatum. And I think that's fair. He's ahead of guys like Joel Embiid, Ja Morant, Kevin Durant. But I think Doncic, Antetokounmpo, Tatum, that's fair. Tatum right now, the Celtics are on a burner, 9 straight wins. Tatum's playing unbelievable. Giannis, of course, two-way brilliance, and Luka is basically the Dallas Mavericks.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, don't you think, you know, he and Luka are in similar positions if you were to should have judged them right now, and they're both having these great seasons, but the team is, you know, has been hit or miss compared to Milwaukee and Boston?
Yeah. Milwaukee and Boston right now have looked like the most complete teams. And of course, Milwaukee without Chris Middleton still. So there's a chance they go on a run if he's back and healthy and playing well. The really interesting thing, you know, I think you're right on the MVP race. I think for Steph to really be in the conversation at the end, the Warriors have to be a top three or top four team in the Western Conference. DraftKings Sportsbook still loves them to win the Western Conference. They're tied with the Clippers right now with the best odds to win the Western Conference at plus 350. So that will be an interesting thing to play out over the season, is where do the Warriors stack up? If Steph continues this dominance and this brilliance, he may have a chance at that third regular season MVP. As always, see the show notes for details on DraftKings. Without further ado, let's get to this awesome conversation with Steph Curry. All right, let's welcome in the executive producer of Holy Moly, Steph Curry. Steph, thanks so much for joining us.
I appreciate it. You wouldn't, you'd be surprised how much I get that on the
out in the wild
and how many people love that show. So appreciate the love.
Four seasons, right?
Yeah, we're already locked in for five.
Yeah.
Shout out to Rob Riggle, Joe Tessitore.
Good for you. Tommy, I haven't told you this story yet, but I want to start the podcast with a quick story. So we've been trying to get Steph on the pod for a while. There's been some near misses that all, you know, he's a busy guy. I get it. So I'm doing the game last night in Golden State, and I was actually trying to get Jalen Brunson's attention, but I was like looking around the court and I made eye contact with Steph and he gave me a head nod. He dribbles over to center court and RJ and I stood up. And the first thing he says to me, he goes, "Hey, did we ever get that podcast on the books?"
And the look on you.
I had this moment of panic. To provide context, I was immediately going to the airport after the game to fly to Houston to meet Steph here. Jason was flying in today from Oklahoma City. Tommy was flying in from LA. We'd booked rooms. I was like, oh shit. And I was like, it's tomorrow. And you're like, oh right, Houston. RJ thought that was funny.
He loved that one. He apparently, yesterday I had a conversation about on the way to the game, the whole deal, like, I'm hoping we can lock this in because it's been a long time coming to get it on the schedule. But I had to take advantage of the moment.
I don't want to spend too much time because we have so much to get to. But I don't want to spend too much time necessarily on this year's team. But you know, a big takeaway last night in watching the game was Clay's play, and he's a guy who's struggling right now. Were you at the beginning of that game? Were you focused on sort of finding him? Because I thought initially it looked like you were very much in facilitator role.
Yeah, that's part of like the beauty of how we play and what we do. It's all predicated on like creating the easiest shots possible because we have, the chemistry, the right talent to be able to leverage like my playmaking, space and gravity, if you will, and get everybody going. There's certain times and kind of you just feeling out the flow of the game where you want to be a little bit more assertive on getting the ball moving and getting Clay some easy shots early. Cause that changes the whole dynamic of the game. I told him his superpower obviously is shooting the basketball, but he's such a threat, even in whatever percentage he's shooting right now. When his 2 feet are on the floor and he's out there, like people worry about him. So, you know, trying to let the game come to him, but for me, just to be able to, you know, kind of figure out how to get him some easy shots early, get his confidence going. You could tell how much our crowd fed off of it early, and then that changes the whole dynamic of the game. So whether he's making or missing shots is more so just about, you know, warrior basketball, if you will, kind of getting, being assertive on that front early. And obviously I have the ball in my hand, so I get to kind of dictate what that looks like.
I want to get something out of the way, and I should have maybe done this first before I gave Holy Moly a shout out. You're aware that you have stands, right? You have a very loyal fan base. Okay. And you know this because I told you this the very last time I played against you. You and Ray Allen are the only two guys that I ever asked for a piece of memorabilia from. And I said, "Hey, man, this is the last time I'll play against you. Can I get your jersey after the game? Sign it." You were nice enough to do it. Appreciated. But there's these, you know, Steph Curry fans that think that I'm a hater, like I'm a Steph hater. And
how'd you piss them off? That's what I want to know.
See, this is, you're being an asshole right now. No, this is what it is. Cause you see everything.
You see what I think is mostly everything. Yeah.
Yeah. You pretty much see everything. No, I think it really hit sort of hit like a culmination when I was asked on First Take, who would you rather have in the clutch, Luka or Steph?
Oh, yeah.
And First Take is very much a black and white thing. You can't really live in the gray.
Right.
So I chose Luka. My gist of it was he's got more size and this year his clutch stats are better. That was the gist of it. And for like six...
Damn, you did it on like 10 games of the same.
No, this was last season. This was like during the playoffs season. Okay, I was like, it was like one of those 5-minute segments. And I was like, I'm going to go look up clutch stats. very just rational argument here. Yeah, I'm like, oh, Luka's slightly better. All right, that's the thing.
Do you feel like you've always been that way, where you've seen everything, or did you develop that?
I think I developed it mostly trying to rationalize the chaos of like that 5-year run that we were on. You know, making the finals, you know, really not knowing, like that first finals appearance, you have no idea what that level is like till you get there. And, just the amount of attention, scrutiny, the mood swings and narrative changes from game to game and all that. And I was like, I'm active on social media, but not really, but you kind of like live your life the same way you have been, you know, your entire career. And then things just change overnight and you're like, yo, what the hell is happening? There's, way more conversation, way more hot takes and all type of, kind of conclusions about your game. And, you know, you got your stands out there to defend you. You got people that are going to hate on anything that you do. And before you go through it for the first time, like at that level, you have no idea how you're going to respond. And I found that it's nice to be aware of what's going on. And also develop a sense of like comfortability in who I am, because you're going to get asked about stuff. You're going to have, you know, it's 82 games and 9 months of your life. And even now the NBA is 24/7, 365 news cycle. You want to be aware of what's going on, but I'm also so secure in like who I am and what I can do on the floor that it's more entertainment at this point, because it is our world. It is, you know, what we do, and, you know, it's how the team responds to all this stuff throughout the year. So it's nice to know what's going on and have a good laugh at some stuff. But develop that over that 5-year run where you're just on that, you know, on everybody's mind in the basketball world every day kind of.
I think it was Iguodala, but I believe he said that if you have a bad shooting first half, you go on Twitter to read the comments.
I started that during that run. Yeah. Andrew Bogut was the first one that kind of called me out on
that's
it.
Right. It was Bogues.
And, and he it's funny because he actually was kind of bold enough to ask me, like, what are you, and went in the locker room, like, what are you looking at right now? I'm like, on my phone. And that's the thing between the eras. Like, I've heard like KG got pissed off at everybody who even brought their phone in the locker room to, you know, ours is a pretty loose locker room. Like everybody's either looking on your phone before the game, before the coaches meeting, in between, and all that type of stuff. Like, as long as you come with the right mindset when you're out on the floor, you know, nobody really cares about that. But for me, like I was looking at Twitter and looking at some of the, I'll call it hateful messages, but real strong opinions on how you're playing and all that based on, we call it first quarter Twitter. Like, it's the best thing in the world. Like, all the Warriors suck. We're down 6 at the end of the quarter. And then third quarter happens and you're like, all right, you know, you kind of get off on that a little bit. So I enjoy it.
Did you ever have any of those that were like particularly crazy or like threw you off at all? You like saw it and you just couldn't believe it?
Probably. It's hard to pick one example. More so, I started to make it a game. People would tell me to like do stuff in the second half, and I one of our beat writers, Kareth Burke, it's probably 3 years ago. She's like, hey, if you see, she wrote on Twitter, hey, if you see this at halftime, like next time you score, like run down with like an airplane arms, so, like little something like that. And I read it and I was laughing, didn't think none of it. I made my first shot come out the halftime, and I literally did it. She loved it. So, little stuff like that, you just have fun with, because it's a long season, man. I gotta try to have some fun as much as possible.
Is there motivation in this? I mean, I think as human beings, right, whether we're secure or not, I think having some level of awareness about the narrative around you, especially if you're a public figure, I think that's totally normal and totally healthy. But no, I do. I don't have it to your level, obviously. I think it's totally normal. But do you use any of that as motivation, or is it just fun for you?
It's both. Because amount of games you've played, like, sometimes the regular season, it's hard to get up. It's hard to find, you don't ever want to be complacent in what you're doing. And me, I love the entertainment value of it, because, you know, it's part of the game. It's part of being in the NBA. It's part of the show. It's part of, you know, the career arc that you have, from when nobody expected anything to when you're surprising everybody to now are kind of numb to what you do and almost kind of take it for granted. So there's a lot of elements that go into it. And it's kind of like a long arc of, you know, that's 14 years in the league. You can imagine the wild stuff I've read, the wild takes that I've heard about myself, the times you surprise yourself at what you do on the floor, and the fact that you can get through 82 games every year and look forward to a long playoff run and everything that comes with it. I do feel like when it's all said and done, I'm going to miss that part of it because it is such a kind of a, you know, an emotional roller coaster.
I speaking of celebrations, when I'm not hating on you, I've often said that you are the greatest show on earth in terms of the entertainment value, the joy that you play with, and the joy that you get as a fan in watching you. And obviously, part of that is the way you guys play. If you're a basketball purist, there's something very beautiful about seeing the ball move side to side. But the celebrations are really interesting to me. My oldest Knox just started playing. So I go to his practices and I go to his games. And I mean, Jesus Christ, man. It's after every single point. Somebody's doing this. Somebody's doing a shimmy. Somebody's doing LeBron pushdown. I like these kids are 4'4" and they're doing the too small to each other. It makes no sense. The one I wanted to ask you about though is the look away three.
Like, yeah.
Where did that, do you remember the first time you did it in a game?
Yeah, it was, I want to say it was either game three or game four of, our first playoff series against Denver in 2013. And, it was the third quarter. I went on this crazy run. I think I had like 20 something in the quarter. And one of the last threes was right in front of Denver's bench. Backstory, I had always heard about how amazing Oracle Arena was during the playoffs. The We Believe team a couple years before we, or was it 2007 when we, when they made that run to beat Dallas, almost beat, you know, Utah after that. I'd heard like that, this the crazy, it's already the craziest arena and it's loud in regular season and all that, but the playoffs is just a different vibe. So we got into that series. We started it. We were 6 seed, so we started in Denver, came back 1-1. And it's like we walked out and there was this haze around over the court. Fans were like 75% full 20 minutes before the tip off. They're chanting Warriors. It's got a nice aroma in the building. It was just amazing, like amazing atmosphere. So you kind of get wrapped up in that. And then third quarter happened. And we go on this crazy run. I have, you know, knocking shots down left and right. And the last kind of one in the third quarter, right in front of Denver's bench, JaVale McGee's standing, like literally standing up. The whole, it's like five or six guys around him, and get the ball in the corner. And there, like, obviously, you've been in that situation where you rise up and everybody's just talking, you know, trash behind you. And for some reason, I just got out of body experience. I shot it. And literally as we let go, it was like I never felt the shot feel better than that. And I turned around and kind of looked at JaVale and then just ran off and it went in. And that was when I didn't even check to see if it went in. I just was waiting for the noise. And it was kind of a really special moment. Just, I don't know, the irrational confidence to even try that in a playoff game, but it was dope.
I was going to ask before this, what do you get more joy out of, like when you guys are on one of those crazy runs where Oracle or Chase is going nuts, or when you're in a visiting an arena and you're just ripping their heart out?
I mean, they all, being at home and being in that kind of a run and feeling that adrenaline rush, there's nothing like it. Because you feel like 19,000 people feel like just, I don't know. It's hard to explain, but that's something that I think I enjoy the most, especially because of the way, like JJ said, because of the way we play. Usually that means the ball's humming all over the place. Everybody's feeling good, you know, kind of walking with your chest out. And it's just a fun way to play basketball on top of the atmosphere. Like silence in the home crowd is dope, and you hope to have as many opportunities to do both, but being at home is special.
Have you ever missed one of those shots in a game?
Yes. I'm sure somebody could put a YouTube compilation of that
together.
But you ever see I don't know if Knox is the fake hustle part of his game yet, where you know you just do like the all out sprint back on defense. But that's my favorite. When I just do it, I half turn, I'm like, that's probably not going. And then you kind of look back and I miss, and then it's a haul ass down, yeah. Getting defense position. Like, oh, I'm locked in. Move on, next play. But yeah, I've done. If I had to guess, I'm probably like 80-85%.
That's good. Yes. That's good. I mean, that's not bad. That's not bad. In a live NBA game, that's fine. I did it. So 15 and 16 was when I felt like my body and shoulder and mechanics and like my legs were probably the best in my career. Cause I had a little shoulder thing after 16 and I'd never shot the same. It was like a scapula thing and I would raise my shoulder. It was weird, but those 2 years I would do it occasionally. Not as frequently as you
can explain how good it feels though. There's a reason you do it.
There's a reason you do it because it feels the biomechanics of it are just so perfect. And because you've shot thousands and thousands of shots, you know, the feeling of when it's perfect. It's not always a swoosh. Sometimes it's the one that hits kind of the back rim where the net doesn't even move.
The Larry Bird make.
Yeah. The net doesn't even move. That's the best make there is.
Yeah.
But I did miss one time. And I don't know why I did this, because I did it on a pull-up like 17 footer. It was like we were playing Minnesota and I was like, it was like a random January game in the third quarter. Like it was a meaningless shot. I missed it. And I was like, why did I fucking
did anybody did call you out on it?
Oh yeah. Okay. You know CP sees everything. I was about to say. the confidence, you said irrational confidence. So I'm using your words here. That irrational confidence. I think the world was sort of introduced to that during that Davidson run your sophomore year. Did you always have that irrational confidence as a player?
Funny you say that. There's a nice documentary coming out called Underrated that we're launching in January, but it kind of documents the before, during, and after the Davidson run. And a big part of it is, you know, I was a late bloomer as a basketball player, as a scrawny, skinny kid on the end of the bench until the team ran zone and they put me in to be a zone buster type vibe all the way through high school. Like I was kind of a pass first playmaking point guard that coach, my parents, sometimes teammates had to always tell me to shoot more because it just wasn't the way I saw the game, even though I knew I could shoot. But that kind of came forced. When I got to Davidson, because we had an amazing point guard there named Jason Richards, who was team captain, team leader, voice of the team, and was an unbelievable setup guy. So I had to play the two, and it kind of unleashed that element. He made my life a lot really easy when I got to college, because I could run around screens, and the way that we played is, you know, motion offense and all that. And so I kind of got wrapped up in that experience, and it kind of unleashed a new way of, you know, playing the game that's very similar to how I do it now. So I didn't really have there's a clip of me and my brother, and we were in Toronto when I was 12 shooting before the game, and I'm like shooting from half court, and as a, you know, got the little holster shot that I used to have back then, and I tried to shoot all type of stuff. When I got in the game, it wasn't really that type of vibe of what you see now. So it's kind of an evolution of just, like you said, the amount of reps that you put in, the deserved confidence of, you know, being able to go out there and take some chances, you know, play with a little bit of creativity, continue to surprise yourself and push the envelope, and then really never lose that spirit no matter how, you know, deep you get into your career, because I've always feel like I'm still on that journey.
Did you have a favorite of those tournament games?
Probably the Georgetown game, just because I think the first one was just special because we got our coach's first college, you know, or first NCAA tournament win. And, you know, he just retired after 33 years of running, Davidson program, Coach Bob McKillop. And to get him that first win was amazing. But the second game we played Georgetown, they were the second seed and we were down 16 in the second half and came back to beat him. I'll never forget that energy in the building, because there was a lot of UNC Tar Heel fans in there, and Georgetown had beat Carolina the year before in the tournament. So we kind of had a pseudo home game because everybody hated Georgetown in the building, including the Carolina fans. and you know, to be a 10 seed and be a 2 seed and go to Sweet 16 was special. So that was probably my favorite for sure.
The next game, the Sweet 16 game, Wisconsin. I think that was the game Bron was at, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we had witness shirts and everything, like red witness shirts. This is crazy.
This is what's wild to me, because like at the time, it's like, oh, this great story about this college kid at this small school, you know, Dell's son or whatever, and LeBron is at his game. I want to kind of try to understand your mindset at the time. I mean, I don't know if you thought, like, I'm going to league, I'm going to be an all-star. Could you ever have imagined playing against Braun in the finals five straight times at that point?
Nobody would ever believe it. It's just because it's a great question. That's exactly. I wouldn't, after we lost in the Elite Eight to Kansas, even at that point, I still wasn't thinking about the league. Like, the first question I got in the locker room after the game was like, hey, you declaring for the draft? I was like, what? What are you talking? Like, we're in here crying, like, mad we lost. And it's the first time I really kind of contemplated like that would be, like that was the time. I knew that that was the end goal, but it wasn't a means to an end type of situation. So to be in the tournament run, and I wish y'all could have been like on our team bus, like driving up to, or in Detroit, going back and forth from the game, and you hear these rumors like, hey, I think Bron's coming to the game. Like, what? Like, yeah, they're playing Detroit later. Somebody called the Davidson staff for some tickets for Bron to sit in our section. We're like, what are you talking about? This is right. You know, this is probably his fourth year in the league. And so nobody believed he'd show up. And then we get to the forward field, and lo and behold, like right when the tip off is coming, here comes Rich, Bron. I was trying to think who else was over there. He had like five or six people, and you know, he's there just being a fan and watching us play. So to think, fast forward, you know, 6 years later, we'd be playing against each other in the finals and all that. It's kind of, it's just a wild experience. I still have, in my dad's house in North Carolina, I still have a Bron jersey on the wall in my bedroom. He signed the next year. He came to Charlotte, and I went to the game. And he signed a jersey, and it's like the greatest shooter in North Carolina or something like that. And he wrote and signed it, and I kept it, gave me the shoes after the game and all that. So it's still wild just to think about the journey since then, because who would have ever thought that?
Before we move on from sort of the Davidson stuff, how lightly were you recruited? Because there's all these different stories about who did offer you, who didn't offer you. Virginia Tech offering you a walk-on spot where your dad played. Like, was Davidson the option? Was that the only option? Or were there other, like, bigger schools?
Two, on my list, it was Davidson, Winthrop, and Virginia Commonwealth. So Jeff Capel was at VCU at the time. Greg Marshall was at Winthrop. And that was the list. It was during my senior year too. So we're in the middle of preseason. Like, I think I gave a verbal commitment to Davidson probably the 1st of December. So it's pretty late in the process. But, it's crazy to think Davidson was always at the top of the list just because I knew Coach McKillop. They were graduating 7 seniors, my senior high school. So I knew the way that he pitched, like you have to earn it, but you have an opportunity to play right away. And that kind of excited me just about getting my feet wet early and not have to play behind anybody, no matter what level it was. And, just the fit of the, you know, his style of play and all that. But God has a funny sense of humor. Like, that was my list. And as soon as I declared declared to Davidson, after that season, Greg Marshall went to Wichita State and Jeff Cable went to Oklahoma. So they both left, not because of I didn't come, but that was just, you know, like I would have signed up to two schools that both coaches would have left. So it's kind of just the timing and kind of the fortune of that I had a coach that was going to bring the best out of me. I had a program that was technically a mid-major, but had not really had much success on the tournament, you know, stage. So I kind of could develop under the radar and just go through the ups and downs of becoming a college basketball player and building my confidence.
So you were mentioning this earlier, but your thought process between sophomore year and junior year about going to the draft or not, why did you decide to come back after, you know, at that point, the whole world sort of knew who you were and what you could do?
Part of it is just such a natural process to like the journey of, you know, freshman year, just getting your feet wet, you're playing well. I was trying to chase KD in the freshman scoring title and all that. He beat me. Then he declares for the draft. I come back. We have that tournament run. And that's really all you're focused on. Like, I'm not thinking about the NBA. It's just, how can we, you know, take that next step as a team? Then right after the tournament, I spent the next 2 months kind of gathering some information and really thinking about, like, is this something that is the right time for me? Is my game, physical stature ready to make that jump into the league? And what I kind of came to was, for me to be successful on the NBA level and give myself the best chance, was to come back and play more point guard role. Because like I said, I had Jason Richards, who's the main ball handler, and I was just coming off screen shooting. I played a little bit like backup point when he went to the bench, but I needed a whole season to kind of rep that or get some reps as a point guard, a playmaker, but still keep my, you know, my scoring threat up. And that's all that next year was, knowing I was going to get attention from all type of crazy defenses and all that. That one coach run a triangle and two just on me for...
Oh, I watched 40, games 40 that minutes. Year. I'd be like, man, like, what is this guy doing in college right now? Like, this is not... I actually, my thought that whole year, because I probably watched 5 or 6 of your regular season games.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know that this is preparing him for the NBA.
I was there just coming down, run a play,
no triangle.
You get off, he's, you know, getting the ball back, just shooting. But it was more so just, you know, being a having the ball in my hands to balance playmaking and scoring. We didn't even make the tournament my junior year. We lost to St. Mary's in the NIT, which is also kind of ironic because that's in Walnut Moraga, California, which is 20 minutes from Oracle Arena. So my last game was literally in my new home and had no idea. So it was dope.
If you've been following the pod, you know I'm stepping my suit game up as I'm calling more and more games. So shout out Indochino for getting me all prepared for this home stretch of games. It's also wedding season, so you can get in on looking great. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into the wedding season looking like $1 million, even though the suits start at just $499. You can either book an appointment at one of their showrooms or do what I did and set up your measurement profile on Indochino's website and choose customizations without even leaving the house. I just ordered a nice plum suit with pinstripes. I'm trying to tap into my inner Walt Frazier, and I think it's working. The entire process was super simple, and the suit fits great. That's the sweet spot. So look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code OLDMAN to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code OLDMAN. If you're like me and appreciate great quality, easy-to-wear clothes in your closet, let me introduce you to Rails. They're a Los Angeles-based brand that blends their California roots with an elevated European aesthetic, and the fabrics feel as good as they look. From super luxe button-downs and essential outerwear to vacation-ready shorts and tees, Rails is consciously crafted for the modern man on the move. With the sun coming out, I recently got myself a few short sleeve button downs, and they are super light and comfortable. Try Rails for yourself at their flagship stores in New York, San Francisco, Boston, London, Paris, and beyond, or at rails.com. And take 15% off your order with the code JJ. That's 15% off with code JJ at rails.com. You're obviously, a mature, thoughtful.
Sometimes.
No, mature, thoughtful person who I assume you have a lot of like reflection time in your life to think about this incredible journey that you've been on. Do you ever think about what ifs? The what ifs in your career?
All the time. And probably lead me to the, had I got drafted by New York instead of Golden State or Minnesota even. Had they picked me, not, Johnny Flynn or Ricky Rubio. So definitely think about all that. Even, you know, the ankle injuries early, the Monte Ellis trade, like, you know, in the league, there's
Stan versus Steve.
That part too, which is, and I didn't even want Mark to get fired. So.
Yeah.
So, like, there's a lot of fortune in this league. There's a lot of, you have to have an awareness of what's going on to appreciate, you know, the journey in real time. Because if you fight it, like, sometimes you kind of, you know, you miss your window. But then there's a lot of trust too. And, you know, specifically Bob Myers, who, you know, since I've my second, third year in the league, since he came on in the fray and the way that he's approached the job and, you know, the good decisions that he's made and thinking and, you know, bringing Coach Kerr in, which was a really like tumultuous conversation situation. Cause, I was fighting it like hell. Like I did not against Steve. I didn't want them to fire Mark for anything. And that he loves the conversation that we ended up having. He's like, I'll trust you to, you know, this is what you think is right for the team, but don't mess this up. And that's one of his favorite lines that I said to him, not knowing who they were going to hire and all that, to help us get to the next level. So when Steve comes in and we win a championship the next year, but, definitely reflective on all those, you know, all the context of that and just the teammates that you play with. Cause, that is the stuff that you remember.
I, you know, on the Knicks front, it's sort of like when I think about if LeBron had gone to college. When I was in school when Dwight came out of high school, and I know Duke was recruiting him, and I think about like certain players in certain arenas, like Dwight Howard dunking in Cameron Indoor Stadium. No, I'm serious. LeBron playing like in an ACC conference game and like taking off from just inside the, like, you think about that stuff. And I, because of that MSG performance, when you had, that was sort of your coming out party in the NBA. Not that you weren't a good player before that, but that was, you know, 54 points, 11 threes. And you think about like Steph for the last 14 years in MSG, not that Oracle's not great. That's why it's like, it's so interesting to me. By the way, I looked it up. Your first game in MSG, I don't know if you remember this, was November of your rookie year. You played 2 minutes and 35 seconds and didn't score.
That's I tell all the young guys, that's, even the crew we have now, I had to go through the ropes too. That was Don Nelson put me in the rookie doghouse. And, it's funny too, cause that game, I didn't play at all. He put me in like the last 2 minutes. I got a block on David Lee. He came baseline and I trapped the box. I'm not gonna meet him at the rim. I timed it right where I kind of got up above him and I was like, get that shit down. And he looked at me. And we went in transition and he came up like nose to nose with me and like said something to me. He's like, who's this freaking rookie coming out here playing garbage time, talking trash? Then the next year we're teammates. It's just amazing how the league works. But yeah, I rode the pond for a little bit my rookie year.
Is it true draft night that you almost got traded to Phoenix?
Yeah. So this is, the NBA is such a small world. Steve Kerr was the GM of Phoenix at the time. And part of the conversation leading up to the draft was, I guess Golden State didn't think I was going to be around at 7, and whoever they drafted was going to be part of some trade to get Amari, to Golden State. And then as the draft was unfolding, I think Phoenix loved it even more because they were like, oh, we're going to get Steph now. He can play behind Steve Nash for a little bit, learn the ropes. And then Larry Riley, who's the GM of the Warriors at the time, Don Nelson, I guess, changed the tune in terms of as the draft unfolded. I was there at 7, so they drafted me and kept me. I don't know all the different conversations that really happened on that front, but I know that was a kind of a foregone conclusion going into the draft and things changed. So kind of crazy that Steve was a part of that and then 5 years later is now coaching me.
My Knox, who I mentioned, and Kai, my youngest son, they've gotten really into watching NBA YouTube highlights. And every morning they come downstairs, they watch the top 10. And anytime somebody like Kevin Durant crossed Daniel Gafford the other day and he fell. Anytime that ever happens, Kai, my youngest, would be like, Dad, you made Steph fall.
Yo, every time.
Only reason I thought of that was because you brought up the Mark Jackson. We beat you. It was game seven in the 2014 series. And what's crazy is I didn't even put a move on you. I just literally, I've always wanted to ask you this. I really have. So I'm like, you're in help position. I'm on the left wing. I think it was CP just swung it to me. And your momentum was going this way. And I just drove away against your momentum. And then you hit the deck. I made the shot. But I'm like, I still haven't figured out how you fell.
Hey, man. I wish I knew too, because I wouldn't have done it. But it was payback. It was payback. I think it was game. So I say this too. It's hilarious we're having this conversation now, because my defensive presence was always like the question mark, especially in the playoffs. I was going to get picked on all the time and all that. So I started to have that, like, that little brother kind of syndrome of, like, yo, stop picking on me, man. Like, I'm trying my hardest. Like, I'm out there giving effort, trying to get better. So anytime I had any type of defensive play, like, you see, like, my heart come out of my chest. I'm like, I'm like looking at the bench and doing the whole thing. So I got a stop on you in game six, I think it was. I actually got a block. So the part of it was like, I had like this reaction. It wasn't even about a shot. I was like, I got to stop. Yeah, like, now what? It didn't matter who it was. So I was like yelling, like flexing at the crowd and doing all that stuff. But then I got humbled.
No, you got humbled. I drove left over across from your bench in the left corner. And you bought it. In fairness to me, shot clock was winding down. I had to get up.
Hey, that's when your best moves come out, when you're free. Like, you know, you gotta do something.
That's true. We talked a lot about with Draymond when we had him on about a year ago. This was not the live show, but back in January, we talked about because I don't really consider it a rivalry, because we never won anything of significance. But we talked about that Clippers stuff, Clippers Warrior stuff for those few years. So I don't want to get too much into that. There's two plays I want to talk about, though, which happened within a month of each other in 2014.
Okay.
So the first is wearing the baby blues with the t-shirts in Golden State. I think it's Matt Barnes, Chris Paul, Spencer Hawes, DeAndre Jordan. I'm shouting out all my guys, and you literally dribbled through them.
Oh, that was my, yeah.
And Jeff Van Gundy on the broadcast is like, I think that's the best move I've ever seen.
It didn't make any sense, because all those two guys that are out there, they're like in one section of the court, right at the top of the key. And then there's four of us like above the 3-point line. So just so much traffic, and Bogut swings it to, or I think Draymond swung it to me, and Bogut set like this weird screen. And you just go into autopilot. Like, you have no, I know there was four people there, but you don't, like, every move I did was perfect. And I didn't, it just came off. Went between, behind, and like CP tried to swipe at it, and I didn't even feel him. And to all that point, like, you see, my favorite thing is Coach Kerr was trying to instill like discipline in our offense and always move it, get, you know, good shot to great shot and the whole deal. So I do this whole move, and they got the camera on him, and he's like, as I'm turning around to shoot, because Clay's wide open on the right wing, and I'm the right play is to kick it to him, but I'm just an autopilot, and I make it, and he walks back to the bench, and actually Draymond's behind me, and he's pointing at Clay, like, pass it to him. So somebody sent me that clip afterwards, and when Jeff said that, I was crying laughing on the way home. He said that might be
the greatest move I've ever seen. My two favorite plays, selfishly, the first one is the fact that I was on the court, but I was not one of the guys that you dribbled through. I was in the corner guarding Harrison. And I was like, oh shit. Second part of that was any rational human being, and I mean this sincerely, like any rational human being that would be willing to try a move like that and dribble through four people and then safely make it through that obstacle course with their back turned to the basket, would pick the ball up. Thank God they didn't turn it over and move the ball. And you were willing to double down. You were willing to double down. And you mentioned creativity earlier. And I've said this about you. I mean this, like, as an observer, I've never I have not seen a basketball player consistently get to a flow state better than you. Are there exercises you do? Is it your training? Like, how are you able to capture that? We talked about the look away shot. That's being in flow state, right?
Yeah.
Not many people ever get to that. You get to that so consistently.
I mean, you got some proprietary information right now. I feel like most of it is.
I feel like Brandon Payne can give me this.
he's going to clip the hell out of this because I was where I was going. Because a part of the training, and anybody who's watched me train in the summers or, you know, how I approach, even in season skill work and all that, like there's a level of obsession about the details. When it comes to footwork, when it comes to balance, when it comes to, you know, how the ball is entering the bat, like the rim at the right angle, arc and all that type of stuff. There's a legit, you know, obsession around that. And I feel like that's been developed over the course of my life, but also, you know, year two in the league where I really understood the unlock that can be there in terms of, like you said, kind of, being creative about how I can play. Visualizing, you know, stuff that maybe I've never done before and then trying it in a skill session or practice or whatnot. That confidence that comes behind that is just, it's intoxicating. And then you get in the game and you kind of lose yourself in that. And then you go back to the drawing board and you keep doing that over and over and over again. And I'm in my 14th year and I'm still doing it. And so it's that old like cliche, like no shot I've, you know, tried in the game I haven't tried in practice before. It's pretty accurate. Like I might even have had four cones, four guys around to do that move, but I've done that dribble combination before.
Maybe you said the word autopilot, and I thought that was super interesting where something like that appears to be spontaneous.
For sure. And it's muscle memory and it's, you've gotten your body and your mind connected before in that regard. And then it comes out when the lights are bright. So, you know, like you said, my guy B Payne's had a lot to do with that in terms of taking my work ethic and my willingness to, you know, get in the gym and push the envelope, being creative with me on that front. Even now, got a guy called Bergstrom who's helped me work on my body and get strong, work on my core, all the things that can take my game to the next level at the biggest of stages in the playoffs when things slow down and you get into that physical tug of war match out there. So it's always a continued reiteration, which is why I still feel like in my 14th year, I'm still getting better, still getting more efficient, and find ways to improve, even though, you know, history says you should be going the other way. So, I say flow, like flow state and like just being in that flow is exactly, you know, how it's where I want to be. And when you're in that, there's no better feeling.
The other Clippers play we wanted to bring up was you dropping Chris.
CP.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I only laugh because I love CP. We go way back to our North Carolina days. And it's funny because, you know, when I got drafted, I spent the whole summer with CP working out. He took me around. I went on a family reunion with him to Disney World. We were working out leading up to my rookie year. So he showed me, he was one of the guys that actually showed me what it meant to like work hard in the league. You think you know until you don't know. And then you get somebody to show you and it's like, oh, that's where I got, okay, I got you. That's where I got to get to. So he was the first one to kind of demonstrate that for me. But then I got into that, that play. It's funny because how y'all used to guard me, like I always was trying to come off the first drag screen and just pull up. And CP was so loud every possession, like, get up, get up. He was yelling at Blake or DeAndre to get up on the screen so I couldn't shoot. And every time he played you, I was like so frustrated because I knew I could get to that shot against pretty much every other team, but y'all would not let me do it. So that play, I hear CP yelling, get up, get up. So I like come off and DeAndre's kind of on my hip and he lets me go. And another autopilot move, like you kind of go into it. And then I saw him fall. And then, you know, the pressure, I don't know when you dropped me, if you felt the pressure that you had to make the shot, you had to make the shot, but I felt that too, but I tried to keep a stone face because when it went in, I had to run back like nothing happened. And I saw the whole bench go crazy. But CB was a he was a soldier on that front. He, I think he texted me. I was like, "Yeah, you got me on that." for him to acknowledge it was hilarious though.
Well, again, like I said, I didn't actually make a move. I just drove a closeout. So it wasn't that
good
I was like
disciplined basketball.
It wasn't that I was like, "Oh, I dropped Steph. I gotta make the shot." It was more like out of my peripheral. I was like, "Did he just fall?" Oh shit! You know, the shot was already in the air.
It was in the air.
The 15 finals. It's something I've wanted to ask you about a long time, and we've talked to Iggy about this when he was on the pod a couple years ago. Number one, did you feel like you deserved MVP in that finals? And number two, as sort of the one missing piece of the resume for the haters on Twitter, for the narrators on Twitter, how much did that sort of fuel you, motivate you, bother you up until this past season?
So the question, I feel like I deserve it for sure, because I feel like comparison was the saying, comparison is a thief of joy. Right?
It's another Jeff Van Gundy quote.
I feel like when you're in, like, that was kind of what I was kind of talking about earlier. When you get into that finals, you don't understand the magnitude of the narrative, right? You don't really, and then when it's about you, there's no better lesson than being in it. And so that 2 weeks felt like an eternity. From game one going to overtime and winning, Kyrie getting hurt, to game two, the whole Dellavedova experience. And, you know, that started the narrative of, you know, our little back and forth. Bron was playing out of his mind. Then we go to Cleveland, we're down 2-1. And it's like, oh, you're comparing, you know, my stats to other NBA or other MVPs in the finals, other finals MVPs. And you get to game three, four, or 4, 5, 6, and we win 3 in a row and win the series. And Andre and his defense and his presence and that adjustment we made in the middle of the series, unlocking another level for us and him playing out of his mind. Bron still having crazy stats, but like, it's just the power of the narrative is it can distract you from what the actual goal is, right? So I felt like, obviously, we're not winning the finals if I don't play the way that I played. I felt like I played extremely well. We don't win the finals unless Andre plays, you know, the way he did, and that adjustment working, and, you know, him giving us such a huge boost throughout the whole series. So we both thought we probably deserved it. I'm sure when he heard his name called, he was like, "No, it's him." It's like, and if it was me, it'd been the same thing. But it never dawned on me like I wouldn't have another opportunity to get one, or the fact that he didn't deserve it. So it's kind of I'm not trying to, you know, run around it. It's literally, that's how you, when you're in it, if that's how we got there, it's kind of very, it's very unique to the Warrior experience. Even when KD wins it twice, cause it's the same kind of conversation. Like, I can go home, put my head on the pillow and know, like, we're not winning unless I do my job.
Unless you go for 27-8-8 both years. Yeah, exactly. So, no, you suck, dude. You didn't win MVP, you suck. No, actually last year, I can't remember. I don't know if it was before or after game three. And I actually
last year?
Is last year. I want to push game three to later. But I don't know if it was before or after, but I remember, like, there were a couple days where people like, "Yo, if the Warriors win, man, like, Wiggins should get MVP." And I'm like, "Nah, man, what the fuck are we doing here? Like, he's playing great. And you're right. For y'all to win, Wiggins has to play great. What are we doing here?"
It's amazing. I don't know if it was it like this, you know, back in the Lakers dynasty days or the MJ dynasty. I don't know. I would love to go back in time and just relive the build up to the series, the in between games, all the different conversations. Cause you get bored of hearing the same stuff. You got to kind of get wrapped up in the series.
The legacy part of it. And, right. And like
rewriting history in the moment.
The check boxes. Right.
Yeah.
In the moment, the check box, like, we were actually having this conversation earlier about you specifically, and because we brought up last year and you know, you winning finals MVP, and I was like, people want to put Steph and Kevin and Bron, like, this is where they rank all time. And I'm like, dude, Steph's 34. He's averaging a career high. Can we wait like 5 years and just see what happens?
It's like the funny one I hear now is, you say I hear everything. It's like in my top 10 in the history of the game, right? That's the conversation. And it's like, oh, if I win that finals MVP, like, oh, it helps. But everybody has their list and all that. And then going into this season, is he top 10 in the, who is sitting here making up, like you're talking about, who's sitting here at the gate of the top 10 list? Like, all right, we got a check. Yeah, check. Yeah. Ah, that right there.
Doesn't have
like,
that.
You're like you say, you're writing history in the moment. And it's, when you talk about it, you're either going to be all the way over here, or all the way over here. And some, it's always somewhere in the middle. So, the only thing about the finals MVP this year that just made me laugh was like, I'll never hear that question again. It kind of made me sad. Like, I'll never hear that question again. Oh, he didn't have a finals MVP. Cause now it's like, well, I'll get another. It just, the goalpost changed. And that's, when you're around long enough and you're playing games that matter, that's part of it.
Does whether or not you're top 10 or top 4 or top 5 or top 2 to your top 1 to your stands, like does any of that matter to you?
It might down the road, just because, like you say, when it's all said and done and I'm not playing a game, then we can have a legit conversation around what does it actually mean to be top 10? How do you compare eras and all that stuff? Of course, like you dedicate your life to this. Like you want to be recognized as one of the greatest. I'm not obsessed about it right now because who the hell is making up this the requirements?
Perking me. Yeah. It's part of the other side where I get to hate on you.
I can't wait. Yeah, I'm going to have a microphone in 15 years and just pick my target and with other current guys.
Do you have any favorite memories of the 24-0?
Oh, man. That was a wild. I'm thinking about that now. That was actually insane. It's
crazy time.
Think about 20, like we're only, what are we, six right now, seven, nine. We're 16 games in. The amount of team meetings we've had, the amount of drama has been around. We haven't won a road game, like all this other stuff. As it currently stands, hopefully when you see this, we've won a game. But
hopefully when this comes out, you will have beaten Houston.
A part of it is like, that's a long time to hold, like coming off a championship to hold down like this level of excellence. 20, like eight more games and we still haven't lost. It's wild to wrap your mind around, but we were still in that kind of FU mentality to the whole league because people were talking trash about our first championship and, you know, all the injuries and all that, like all the narratives that came out of that. So we were kind of, we were more motivated than ever. But I think the memory that I got is just, when it ended, because we played Boston. I had a Boston Milwaukee back to back game 24 and 25. Boston game went to double overtime. We ended up winning. We got to the hotel in Milwaukee at like 4 a.m. and had the quickest turnaround ever. We get to the arena in Milwaukee and they have 24-1 shirts like in the stands for their whatever that section that they have. That goes nuts, and they had 24, and they're just chanting it the whole game. And it's like, that's really not a, that's really not a dig.
It's not what you think it is.
Like I actually took one home after the game. I was like, yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, the other teams are 24-1 at one point, so appreciate y'all for calling it out. But they ended up winning. Obviously, we were a little slow on that, but 24-0 was crazy. Think about
it. On the reflection piece. How do you contextualize or think about 2016? Because it was, again, as a peer, a competitor, as a now observer and someone who has to talk about these things, it was one of the most magical seasons in NBA history.
For sure.
You guys go 73-9, you get to the finals again, you have a unanimous MVP season, you take this jump too in 16. Where you were great in 15, MVP, all that, like you were the best player on the best team. Like, but there's a jump that you made in 16. How do you sort of contextualize that year as part of your career?
It comes with a lot of emotions, right? You just explained it really well. The 73-9 chase, you're starting 24-0, coming off a championship, getting everybody's best shot, still winning. I don't know at what point we started to even talk about 73-9. I'm trying to like, it was probably right after the All-Star break. You start to think about, oh, if we win, you know, 7 out of 8 games just the rest of the way, we're going to get there. And then it became a huge talking point probably the last 20 games. And we carried that all the way through and actually got it done. I remember that game set 82. Two games going on at the same time, us playing Memphis, chasing the 73rd win. Meanwhile, in LA, it was Kobe's last game playing against Utah and scoring 60, whatever he did. So just NBA was at its height. Then we go through the playoff run, and I actually here at in Houston, I slipped on the floor and busted my knee. Was out for however long. We come back, and game 6, Klay was born. In OKC, then you get to the finals and you're up 3-1 and you're already kind of counting, you know, the win is like, just get it done. Draymond suspension, all that, it kind of is a little distraction, but you're like, we're still right there. Like, we're about to be 2-time like defending champs back to back and the whole vibe. And know how it ended. What I say about that 3-1 situation is I've never seen two guys play at that level
for three straight games.
It was the craziest thing I've ever seen. Like, Bron and Kyrie were just on, like, we play well. They just play better. And it was hard to watch and be in that vibe where you couldn't do anything about it. And, you know, we still had an opportunity to win game 5 and 7 down the stretch. And then the Kevin Love possession, which is one of my, like, if there's like one play, like, I know I should have done something different. It's that one. There's way more time on the clock than I thought. Me trying to answer Kyrie's 3 over me was kind of in my head. And, you know, you force up a shot and you kind of lose momentum and they win on your home floor. But you can always tip your hat to somebody who just outplayed you. And that's what they did for 3 straight games. So the whole season was insane to think about all the experiences we had. The fact that we have a 73-9 banner in our practice facility, but no NBA Finals banner that year, still hurts. But you know, it's part of the journey. And every time I see Kyrie, every time I see Bron, like, there's that respect of, you know, those 5 years were crazy, or 4 years playing against them were crazy. Just fast forward to 17. I think game 1 of 2017 was the best basketball that's ever been played. Like, on both sides, everybody was at peak form. It was the most intense, most exhilarating game I've ever played in. It was the first game of the final. So, all that stuff you remember, pretty vividly.
That run, how exhausting was that? Did it take its toll? No, did that whole, that 5-year stretch?
Oh, yeah.
Just playing, because I think, again, I did one finals. I didn't win a chip. But I just remember it was like playoffs, different. Yeah. Second round, different. Conference finals, different.
Then you got finals, break.
Super Bowl, mm-hmm. Like Super Bowl. And you guys did that 5 straight years.
Bron did it 9 straight years, right? Is that right? Eight straight years? Yeah. With 3 different teams, but 8 straight years. So, yeah. It brought the best out of us. I'd call it exhausting for sure, but you always met the moment. Like, you surprise yourself at what you can kind of stir up in terms of that competitive energy. The fact that over those 5 years, I think we played over 100 playoff games. So we played more than a season than anybody who didn't make the playoffs those 5 years. It's just, and that's not just the actual games, but the intensity is, you know, 2-3 times what it is in the regular season. The preparation, the mental focus you got to have, what you put your body through, all that. But we always met the moment. So that it begs the question, like, after 2019 finals, KD gets hurt, Klay gets hurt, we lose to Toronto. Then that next fall, I get hurt, I break my hand, miss that season. We have the COVID season, and then we come back and win this year. Like, did we need that break? And it's a hard question to ask. I felt like we could have kept, if everybody was healthy, we could have kept meeting that moment, meeting that level. But it did help, like, to have a nice little, you know, restart and figure out what was necessary to get back to that level. But yeah, it's crazy to think about just the games that you played, the competition and the intensity of those games on the court, and how you surprise yourself with what you can kind of bring, you know, to the table and, you know, throughout that journey.
A lot of people, players included, coaches, you know, fans, of course, do this a lot. But when you add a piece to a team, or they make, you know, a team makes a trade, and all of a sudden there's a, you know, a media day photo of three players, and you see, and it's like, oh, it's scary. You know, I think Harden said scary hours, or that team's going to be scary.
My favorite.
Whenever I think of the KD Warriors, I think of Spencer Hawes, because this dude, when we're playing cards, anytime he has a good hand, he always says, y'all are so fucked. and I'm thinking about, like, y'all getting KD and coming off what you've just done the prior 2 years and just being like, man, y'all are so fucked.
I got a funny story for that. So that summer, KD's, it was what, July 1st, whatever. I think maybe 3-4 weeks after that, Drake was performing at Oracle. So we go to the concert, and it's one of those like situations where stage is up here. We're kind of back here in like the little VIP section, whatever. It's like me and Draymond. I think Katie was there. We're all kind of just, everybody knows we're there, but it's not like a big deal. It's just freaking Drake. So Drake's performing, and he gets on this, like, I don't even know, it's like a lift that takes him around the arena so he can kind of see the fans and have that moment. So as he's going around, he sees us down there, but doesn't really acknowledge it. He goes past, and he's like, yo, we're in Oracle Arena. It's crazy. Y'all the champs. I know it's a tough year. Man, y'all got Steph, Draymond, KD now. Number 11. So we all start laughing. It was like he was just in the moment. My brother was with us, so Seth's with us. And after we get in the car on the way home, he's like, man, y'all cheating. Because the fact that Drake didn't know Clay's name. Yeah, right. He's like, y'all had so many names. That was my favorite. Like, Seth just acknowledging that, like, that vibe that you're talking about with Spencer. He's like, bro, the fact that he went through the whole roster and got to Clay was like, number 11 is like game 6.
That's amazing.
I was laughing.
What was the basket when he got there? We've talked about this with him a bit. We talked about Draymond too, but when he got there at first, having just been through these wars against him, what was like the basketball fit like immediately, like pre playoffs?
Those are the conversations that we talked about, because he even said it just recently, like, you put me with anybody, I can play with anybody. There's a lot of other context, but like, that's how he plays. We knew that going in, there was going to be a little sacrifice trying to figure out where shots were going to go. Funny part is, we always thought like Draymond's such a great playmaker, point forward type vibe. I was like a 17, 18 shots. Clay was about the same. Katie was like right around 20. So you're counting up the shots in the game and like, who's going to have to make the biggest sacrifice? And at first it was actually me, because Draymond was making, he was a playmaker, and I loved this, you know, set off ball screens and run around and use the gravity and all that. We were creating great shots, but I didn't have a natural flow on the offensive end until probably after Christmas, you know, the Christmas Day game. So, but a lot of the confidence that we could figure it out is because we all knew how to play basketball. We had, you know, high IQ. Nobody really needed to be ball dominant. And so, it would mesh pretty well, and we had a lot of confidence that we could do that. And then you go through the season, you figure it out. Funny part is, it's kind of like last year, where you have this idea of what our peak basketball is, but KD got hurt the last 2 months of that season, or six, maybe 6-8 weeks of that season. And he came back right before the playoffs, so we had to go into the most important time of the year without like having those reps, and so you still have a little bit of uncertainty around how it's going to look.
I felt really bad for you guys.
I was trying.
Like, you knew as soon as you started. Like, come on.
In our locker room, we were trying to figure it out. No, I'm just playing. It, But that's like part of the
come on,
man. We were trying to figure it out, and thankfully we did.
Oh man.
My favorite, I was laughing at first when you first started talking about guys adding up shots, because I remember I don't know if it was like September or media day or sometime in the preseason, but they asked Clay about it, about like sacrificing. It's like, are you worried you're not going to get him as many shots? And Clay's like, I ain't sacrificing shit. I'm shooting 20 times a game.
Yeah.
It's like, that's Clay.
That's right? Clay, baby.
You don't ride an elevator for the music or pick an airline for the movies. So when it comes to audio entertainment, it makes sense to choose Audible. It's the home for stories told by the biggest stars like Ethan Hawke, Kerry Washington, and Kevin Hart. It's home to epic adventures, chilling mysteries, and can't-miss comedies. Audible is the home of storytelling. Let your imagination soar with audiobooks, podcasts, and originals. You know what I love most about Audible? No matter where I am, my imagination can run wild with an action-adventure story, the journey to your best self, the spider web of true crimes, and discover new worlds, old worlds, and how to make a better world.
Audible is the home of storytelling with all your audio entertainment in one app. Find the best of what you love or something new to discover. Audible is an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from bestsellers and new releases to celebrity memoirs, mysteries, and thrillers, motivation, wellness, business, and more.
As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Members also get full access to a growing selection of included audiobooks, Audible originals, and podcasts. You can download or stream our included titles all you want. Right now, I'm listening to The Nature of the Game by Mike Kaiser. Everybody knows I love golf. Mike Kaiser built Bandon Dunes as well as a number of other courses. It's been a fascinating listen. Let Audible help you discover new ways to laugh, be inspired, or be entertained. New members can try it free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/oldman or text oldman to 500500. That's audible.com/oldman or text oldman to 500500 to try Audible free for 30 days. audible.com/oldman. OM3 fans, I need to tell you about the most comfortable pants out there. They're from Vuori, and they're magnificent. I'm not kidding. Jason told me about them. He called them butter on your legs. Vuori provides a new perspective on performance apparel, perfect if you are sick and tired of traditional old workout gear. Everything is designed to work out in, but doesn't look or feel like it. So comfortable, you will want to wear it all the time, and I do. Honestly, it's comfier than whatever you're wearing right now. Now, the pants I mentioned up top is called the Men's Sunday Performance Jogger. Grab yourself a pair. It'll change your life. Vuori is an investment in your happiness. For our listeners, they are offering 20% off your first purchase. Get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet at Vuori.com/JJ. That's Vuori.com/JJ. Not only will you receive 20% off your first purchase, but enjoy free shipping on any U.S. orders over $75 and free returns. Go to Vuori.com/JJ and discover the versatility of Vuori clothing.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
The culture of the Warriors. And culture is this buzzword in the NBA. Execs use it a lot. Coaches, players, everybody talks about culture. And Steve has talked about it, and recently with the Draymond Jordan thing, He called it, I think, the biggest crisis when KD's last year with Draymond. That was a crisis. I'm sure there are other ones that aren't public. I'm sure there was stuff that happened early on with Steve as you guys are figuring them out. But your guys' culture, the fabric of that, has never torn. And I have this theory about superstars, and this is not a knock on any other superstar I've played with, but there's a few anomalies to me. I think Jokic, I think Giannis, Tim Duncan's was this way. Like, it's great to have culture drivers like Patty Mills, but ultimately, if your superstar is the main guy driving the culture, that's kind of the reason the culture doesn't break. Am I off base on that?
No, I mean, not having been around those other guys, I think you're right. You're right on it in terms of just understanding that what's expected of me every night, performance wise, the lead by example type, where it's a little out of context, but what Michael said about, or MJ said in his documentary, about not expecting anybody else to do something he wouldn't necessarily do on the court, and the work and all that. Like, there's an element of that. There's an element of awareness of the value of everybody in the locker room. Like, yeah, the narrative might be, this is my team and you're carrying this load, and where would they be without you? Coach does an amazing job from the first day he came in preaching this, the strength in numbers, you know, tagline, but I try to communicate as often as possible how much I need everybody in the locker room to perform and play their role, and that we'll all get proper acknowledgement throughout the process, because that's how I see things and how I try to live it out on a daily basis. And I feel like that goes a long way for the guys that either have come into our team, like the JaVale McGee's and Nick Young's and Zaza Pachulia's, and the guys that are kind of the glue pieces and have been around but haven't won, and they come in and they see how we operate, and they believe in what we're doing, believe in how my leadership style. Like, I'm not the most vocal guy running in like mother effing people in the locker room or having to dominate, you know, whole court every day, but it's
what Draymond's for.
Exactly. And we have a great kind of, you know, chemistry on that front. Cause the things he needs to say that I can't really communicate in the same, or articulate in the same way, but there's a level of walking that out and doing it on a daily basis that's my job. And, you know, the confidence that builds for everybody, throughout a season. So yeah, I acknowledge the role. I respect it. And win or lose, like, you really understand the dynamic that I can go out and drop 40 every night, and you're not going to win shit unless you have guys that play their role and actually believe in what they're doing. Cause that stuff is very fragile in the league, cause there's a lot of different distractions that can kind of creep in on that.
Yeah. I look at a part of a coach's role in the NBA, obviously the X's and O's, dealing with the media, certainly dealing with star players, but having the 15th guy and this is not only the role of the coach, but this is the role of the star player as well. I think having the 15th guy feel a sense of ownership in the team, having the 15th guy feel empowered, and it's hard to do, man. And you got to have the right guys to do it. And that's where you guys have, I think, done a great job. You consistently brought in those glue guys, but it's hard to do. And what you guys have built is, I mean, beyond just the talent, like, what you've built culture wise is remarkable. Did you see, by the way, the people on Twitter that were questioning your leadership when you had your hands on your shorts?
No, I missed this one. When I had my
hands. This was a thing. When the video got leaked.
Oh, the Draymond thing?
Yeah. Did you see this?
No, but I'm trying to.
But this is another thing where I'm like, what are we fucking doing here, guys?
People say anything though. This is because
I didn't intercede. I had my hands on my shorts, so I didn't respond quick enough.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, whatever it was, dude. I don't know.
But part of yeah, I mean, yeah. I guess you're liable to. I actually didn't hear that one, which was thank God, because that would have pissed me off.
All right,
that would have pissed me off. But a part of it is, yeah, you're gonna be in that situation where you get critiqued about every single thing. Even there's one I've during the season when I broke my hand, Draymond was the only one on the court that was still playing, and there was a play, I can't remember what it was, somebody airballed a shot or something, and I'm standing up like trying to like be supportive, but he airballed it, and I like my face just went stale, and I'm just staring like, what the hell is going on? But I kind of froze, and the camera's just on me the whole time. So then they put me like, oh, him embarrassed with his the Warriors, the state of the Warriors right now. This, you know, just kind of trying to put me against the team in terms of like, oh, Mr. High Mighty over here and this on the court, and it's like those situations. The culture has to take precedent over everything else because they're going to try to poke. They're going to try to position you in certain ways just because the opportunity is there. So I got to be aware of all of that too.
When we had Iggy on last year, we were talking about some of your crazy in-game shots, and he was basically, we were like running through a bunch of them, and we've hit on some of them already, but he was talking about you in practice, and he was like, you guys don't understand, like Steph in practice, like this kind of shit you do in practice is at a so much crazier level than anything you've done. Is there anything that stands out to you in terms of like you did this and maybe there's not even video of it or anything like that, but it's just it's like particularly memorable?
There's, I mean, the joke is it's kind of an everyday thing where you just try random stuff, you know, shooting like one hand slingers from 94 feet that I've made and like called it, like we'll bring in the huddle, whatever, and you're like walking towards half court and you throw it behind your back and goes in. There's one during open practice our last season at Oracle, so 2018-19 season, and we were doing our normal warm-up stuff and the fans are in there and the whole deal, and coach is talking on the PA system and all that, and we like bring it in to go do some warm-ups and stuff, and I was at half court and the ball kind of came at me and I just picked it up and threw it behind my head and it went in. Like nobody else is watching.
There's a video of this one.
Yeah, that one. Yeah, that's my favorite one, just because like I the shot and I make it, and you see my reaction. Like, oh, and Quinn Cook's right there, and like we're jumping up and down, but nobody else on the team had any idea what was going on. It's just my little.
It doesn't make any sense. There's no world where this should go. So,
little stuff like that, but like I told him, is whatever. I mean, we're in the gym all freaking day and practice, and whether it's summer training or practice, shoot arounds, games and all that, you're going to try stuff just because, I still have fun playing basketball. Like that for me is the thing that I hope to never, ever lose. No matter all this drama of the business and wins and losses and all that, like I still get lost in the game. And when you have a ball in your hands, it's just a different energy that I have. And I want to keep that for as long as I can.
I do love the joy that NBA players get from making stupid shots. Like it doesn't actually make sense.
You're still kids, man. Like you're kids. You're literally just kids.
We're like, just kids playing a game. That's all it is. That's all it is.
Bill Russell used to say that. Like he could never really rationalize the business of the NBA because he's like, this is literally grown kids getting paid to play a game. And that was his perspective, which protected him from all the other stuff that was going on in society at the time, and just rationalizing like, why is he in the situation? I think it's a healthy kind of perspective because it reminds you of how blessed you are to be doing what you're doing. It reminds you, there's so many things that you can't control in this league, and injuries and whatever the case is in terms of what's going on with the team and all that. But you're playing basketball, man. It's mad fun.
The benefit to players in today's NBA is that everybody has a camera and every arena has cameras in it and the tracking. So you don't really miss shots made. I don't know if they did this when your rookie year, my rookie year, whenever shoot around with it, everybody would kick the ball as far as they could up into the stands. And then you'd have to go retrieve the balls.
Yeah.
So Turk had a pretty decent leg, I'm going to be honest with you.
He didn't make upper bowl?
Like, He didn't make upper bowl, but he made second bowl.
Okay.
So we're in Detroit, second bowl, and I go chase it. I throw all the other balls back and I go chase it. And they're like, shoot it. Shoot it. I'm like, I can't hear you. No, I'm fucking with you. I was like, all right, I'll shoot it. And I'm like at half court in the second deck and I take the ball. And I mean, you know, I play baseball. I can throw the ball. So I threw it one handed as far as I could. And I was like, oh shit, that's going in. And it swished in with such force. And it's a regret of mine that there was not caught on camera. This is 2006. Like it didn't, there's no video evidence of it. Before we let you go, game four of the past finals in 2022, this past year, as someone who has watched you, be a kind of like a dickhead on the court with your antics and all your celebrations, like in a
loving way. You don't have to sugarcoat that, because that's part of the, so I know you're gonna get to that question, but people ask me, there's a fine line between confidence and cockiness, right?
Yes.
And you just like dickhead in terms of my reactions and mannerisms and all that. Like, I'm sure that's how people interpret it.
Yeah.
And the same. And then obviously the Warrior fans are like, oh, he's just have pure joy, having fun. Like, he's just expressing himself. So you get both sides of it, but it's amazing. Like, it's just authentic in terms of me just enjoying myself out there. I get it's going to be. It probably is. It's this dickhead behavior. a lot of the time, even the turnaround shots where you're like looking at people.
Yeah.
While the ball's in there. But anyway, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm glad you clarified all that. you recognize that there is a line.
Oh,
and you're always toeing the line, which side. But I don't remember you ever showing sort of not the joyful antics, but the emotional antics. I don't ever remember watching you show that in the first quarter of a game, and you did that in game four. Why?
You're right. That was kind of a intentional way I approached that game specifically, because it's kind of the through line of the last 3 years, and you know, watching, you know, injuries happen to my teammates, myself, go through a year where you hear all the doubts of we'll never be back there at that level. Just to fight to make the play-in tournament the year before, and what it took to give ourselves some life. And then fast forward to last season where you believe you can get there, but you really don't. You don't know, because it's a new crop of guys. It's, you know, the older version of us. And there's just a lot of question marks. And then you stay in the moment, plot your way through it, play at a high level, get to the finals. And I have so much experience in that setting. Obviously, you know, that was the 6-1. And it was different because it was Boston. It was in that hostile environment. And it was different because we were tested in a way that, you know, was new. And a lot of it was, you know, the protect, like the core, we have so much trust in what we all bring to the table. When you see this fan base or whatnot, like go at one of your guys and like constantly just berate him and cross the line and do all that, you know, type of stuff. And we lose game three and you're in that environment. It's like, holy shit, like, this is going to be a dog fight. Like, we knew that going in, but this was a different element of emotional, like, response that we hadn't really, you know, seen before. So game four is like, one, you know how big the game is. You lose that game. Well, first off, according to ESPN, we're already 84% underdogs in the final. So now go down 3-1. You might as well not even play after that. So you know how big the game is. But then you get into that, into the first quarter, and we're already down, I think like 12-4 or something like that. We slowly gained some momentum. And I think we were down. I don't know. I hit that one shot and I started like yelling at the crowd. I was like, this is going to be a different motherfucking game. I said that. My mama got mad at me because of my word choice. And I was like, oh, you're right. But I was just unleashing a different level of, like, I'm here, like, we're here. And y'all ain't gonna just have this, you ain't gonna count the parade already in terms of, you know, the 19,000 people that seemed to be in unison on what they were saying every single, possession. Like it was like, we're here and we're gonna respond and, you know, see what happens. And a lot of people talk about just the way that we play, like it's free flowing and it's poetic and there's a lot of movement and, you know, high level skill and all that. But you got to have, you know, that we have the most competitive guys. Draymond complimented Clay. Clay's like one of the most competitive guys that I've ever played with because he wants it so bad. And, Draymond the same. I'm the same. Andre's the same. And so just required another level of response from us. For me, I wanted to lead that, even though we were still down in the first quarter. I was like, I don't know really what I'm talking about, but let's go. And kind of manifested a three game run that was for the books. And game four was definitely my favorite game of my career because of the stakes that were a part of it and the fact that, you know, we lose that game. Who knows if we ever, you know, have a chance to win a championship again.
We were talking earlier about you breaking Ray's record at MSG last year. Have you had a chance? It's been obviously there's been so much going on. Have you had a chance to have just like a little bit of perspective on that, but then also just on how you've sort of changed the game overall? And a lot of people have commented on this over the years, but it's an objectively true thing, but it's also like you're living it. Yeah. So you might not be able to sort of look at it while you're sort of in the middle of it.
A little bit more wisdom's come since I've been in my 30s where I understand like this isn't gonna be around. I'm not gonna be able to play forever. You get a little bit more reflective, I think, in terms of all the things that have gone into your success, the way that the game has changed and the fact that when I got into the league, like that was never a goal. It was just I play the game the way that I play. I stretch the envelope and have a different level of creativity and you start to shoot from deeper, build your range out. You add the ball handling and shot and space creation and all that stuff to it. And then you start to see teams be designed differently. You start to see guys that never really prioritize three-point shooting go to the lab in the summer and try to add it to their game. And then every coach is like, no, not yet. Just hold on to that. But everybody's like really opening up their mind to what that could look like for them. Then you got guys, you know, like what Dame's doing, what Trae Young, how he plays, you know, there's similarities in terms of like what you see inspires you to either add some form of it to your game or open up the possibility, like, hey, I can do that too kind of vibe. So, I'm a little bit more reflective on that and it's really dope, but I never let it get too far. Cause like you said, I'm still in it and still feel like there's another level to get to. Efficiency for me is always the biggest thing. Like how long can I keep up this volume and efficiency balance that, I obsess over a lot. So
you do.
Yeah.
70% true shooting percentage.
I don't even know what that even means. Like I know the number. I don't know how the analytics behind it is like
two pointers, three pointers, and free throws.
I just know if it's above 65, you're doing something good.
if you're the guy though, what are you seeing? Cause you said you ultimately become what you see. Like I think there is a Dame is more your contemporary, but I think there's a lineage to from you to Trey, right? Who was that lineage prior to you?
It was combining Steve Nash and Reggie Miller as like players. That was exactly like I love watching them play, but when I got to high school and then my first year at Davidson, it was can you be as lethal with the ball in your hand as you can with it without the ball, or vice versa? And those two guys were like the models of like watching Nash just be a pick and roll master and all the different passes he would make, his tight handle, and he wasn't the most athletic guy. Like I could resonate with that. Reggie, you know, played against my dad. So every time he played against him, you know how you watch the game and you can only watch one guy and your eyes, I can't watch anything. If Reggie was on the court, I could not watch anything else. I just watched everything he did, his angles he took, the deception, the wild push offs he'd have and he'd run the other way. Like all that stuff, I was just a fan of, and it became pretty clear when I understood my skill set that I could mesh those two guys as like a baseline of how I wanted to play and then take it from there, throughout your career and kind of building or hanging your hat on that style of play. because I feel like I am as lethal off the ball, obviously, as I am with it in my hands.
No, that's what separates you from every other. I said this actually last night on the broadcast. I was like, there's a lot of great shooters. Stat, you're the best shooter ever, but like, there's a lot of great shooters. And then there's like you, because you do everything that every other dominant good player does, and you shoot the ball great. You know, you can ISO, you can play at a pick and roll. You can be a facilitator. You rebound at a high level. You guard at a high level. That's, I mean, I couldn't do any of those things, you know? I couldn't. I'm sorry. I could shoot. I could shoot. We could probably do another hour and a half, but you got a game tomorrow. We do appreciate the time.
Anytime,
this has been awesome, man. Really, really great.
I just happened to walk by the room. I just heard you in here. I didn't know we had an appointment.
The weird coincidence.
Is that JJ's voice?
We ended up in Houston somehow.
All right. Appreciate it, bro.
Absolutely.
If you like The Old Man and the Three, you can listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey. New York Times bestselling author Shea Serrano and Emmy winner Jason Concepcion are back together, this time aiming their high-powered microscope at the NBA in their new podcast, Six Trophies. Jason and Shea break down the league's biggest storylines this All-Star break and all season long by handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities each week. Things like the Denzel Washington in Training Day trophy, given out to the player or team having the best week around the NBA. Or, this is a fun one, the Step Brothers Catalina Wine Mixer trophy, given out to the thing the guys are most excited about for the upcoming week. What's more, Six Trophies is celebrating the All-Star break with a special mid-season episode. The Basketball Oscars will roll out the red carpet for the season's best and worst moments so far. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Six Trophies ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Yo, Trey.
Kevin, what's up, man?
You know, I've been thinking, what would have happened if the NBA never vetoes the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers and we get CP3 in the same backcourt as Kobe in LA?
Well, you get a very happy Jack Nicholson, for sure.
And the Lakers probably win a bunch more championships. CP3 finally gets a ring or two or three, and the Kardashian empire is forever altered.
What did you just say? Hey, everybody, I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier, and we're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass
or play call. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused. Follow Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.